Welcome back to the Union Edge Labor's Talk Radio. I'm Brittany Sheets here with Angela Bachman today.
Hey, Brittany.
Hey, Angela. We're having some fun. We've talked about a little bit about everything, and right now we are going to dip back to Buck Gino of Work in Progress Radio. Welcome back, Buck.
It's always a pleasure, ladies, on Fridays.
So always a pleasure to have you.
We're on the home stretch here now, right?
That's right, the home stretch to the Friday weekend. All righty. So you have a friend with you.
Yeah, I do. In our efforts to educate ourselves and union members and all workers to better support themselves and know that there are people out there to help them, we have with us Tom Good. He's the resident officer of the National Labor Relations Board in Grand Rapids. Tom, thanks for joining us on the Union Edge. We appreciate it.
Well, hello, Buck and Angela and Brittany. It's good to be back.
Well, thanks for joining us, Tom.
It's always great to have you. You know, one of the things, Tom, we've talked about quite often is we've talked about how workers are protected by the Act and also, you know, concerted activity. And there's several things. And I think we've mentioned a couple times, and I really appreciate you bringing it up today, was the fact that probably the listeners and several people have heard us mention the word unfair labor practice. And sometimes I think it would behoove us, and like I said, thanks again for bringing it up, is the fact that maybe we should talk a little bit about what an unfair labor practice is, an investigation is, and how it takes place, and mechanics. How about that?
Sure. Well, you know, the name or the words unfair labor practice are found in the statute in the National Labor Relations Act, but it might be a little bit misleading. I should say right off the bat that not everything that happens at work that is unfair or that feels unfair would be an unfair labor practice under the law. When an employer or a union violates the National Labor Relations Act, that's called an unfair labor practice. And employees, unions, and employers can file a charge with us by filling out a form that accuses an employer or a union of an unfair labor practice, of violating the Act. And it's a simple form. You can find it on our website, which we'll say later on in the program. Or we can mail the forms to you. You can fill them out by coming to any NLRB office. It's one side of one piece of paper. It takes about 5 minutes to fill out. And when we receive a charge form saying that there's been an unfair labor practice, we begin an investigation. And we can't begin an investigation until a charge is filed. So the step one, a charge form has to be filed with us. When a form like that comes into our office, it's assigned to an investigator or an attorney. And almost in every case, our first step of the investigation is to contact the person or the party, the employer or the union that filed the charge, and to ask for their evidence. And the building blocks of evidence that we use at our agency is, for the most part, it starts with an affidavit, a sworn statement by the witnesses, the people who have firsthand knowledge about what happened. So if somebody files a charge with us saying that, let's say, an employer fired me because of my union activities, the first step in our investigation would be to contact that person, have them come into our office, or we'll meet them in the field, and they're going to spend a couple hours with our investigator preparing a sworn statement, an affidavit. Could be 3 pages, it could be 10 pages, more or less. And it'll take a couple hours, but the agent is going to be asking all of the questions, the who, what, when, where, why. So we want to nail down the facts, and that interview is sometimes the most complete picture that we get about what happened. It's a very important step of the investigation, and it's an important thing to remind witnesses if you're meeting with an NLRB agent that it's very important to be to give the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, because you're beginning when you begin a case like that. If this case down the road were to lead to a hearing or some sort of litigation, the credibility of the witnesses is often what the case is going to turn on, because one side is going to say it went down this way, another side is going to say it went down that way, and the judge, at the end of this process, is going to have to make a call as to who's telling the truth. So honesty is always the best policy when you're giving testimony to a board agent.
And so it's an important time that if you have other people that are party to this, such as witnesses, to bring them into the process too, also, right?
Absolutely. Although the investigation always begins with the interview of one witness, it frequently branches out. The investigator knows that usually at the end of that interview who else she or he needs to speak to. Co-workers, other witnesses, we call them neutral witnesses, people who aren't directly involved in the dispute, but who might have firsthand knowledge about relevant facts. If an employee was discharged allegedly for something that they said at a customer's location, we might have to contact the customer or the customer's employees to see, well, what do you remember being said there? We try to eliminate or reduce the areas of factual dispute so that we can focus on then the legal issue. So once we've gathered the facts from the charging party, well, due process and fairness requires we have to let the other side give their account, give their evidence. And as you might imagine, it's not always easy to tell what exactly happened and sometimes the more you dig, the less clear it becomes. But that's the nature of any sort of a legal dispute. And I think that our people generally are pretty good at getting all the facts that we need. And when we've gathered the facts and we've gone back and forth and we've checked one side's story against the other, when we've got the best account that we think we're going to have, then it's time to do some legal analysis and research to see what the board cases have said about similar situations that have arisen in our history.
But also during the course of the investigation, Tom, there can be other charges, so to speak, that come from that, correct?
True. It's not unusual that as the board agent is looking into it, we might find evidence of related conduct by the charged party, the employer or the union against whom the charge is filed, that may not have been specifically written in the charge, but it's kind of related and probably should be investigated at the same time. Our policy then is that we give the charging party a chance to amend their charge or file a new charge that puts that on the table too. And you know, when we get a charge form right at the very beginning of this process, we immediately have to serve a copy on the charged party. It's only fair that the charged party, the employer or the union against whom the charge is filed, should know what's being investigated, what the accusation is. And so after we've gathered the charging party's evidence, we do go to the charged party, the employer or the union, and ask for their response and their cooperation. And most of the time we get some level of cooperation, and in our view, the more the better. And all of that contributes to the bottom line, that is what do we know about what happened?
Well, for the listeners, though, that means the cat's out of the bag, correct? That's when the employer knows who the person is or the employees are, correct?
That's correct. And there's, you know, some people may have some hesitation. Gee, do I really want to kind of out myself as somebody who feels that there was a violation of the law by filing a charge? Well, that's understandable. We do let people know that the law, one of the unfair labor practices defined in the law, is that an employer or a union, it can't retaliate against employees for filing a charge against them, even if the charge winds up that we don't think we have evidence of a violation. Even if the case goes nowhere, while we're investigating or even after we've investigated, after we've closed the investigation, it's unlawful for an employer or a union to retaliate or discriminate against employees merely for having filed a charge or for meeting with a board agent and giving testimony like an affidavit or even just talking over the phone with them.
Well, and that's very true. And the other part about that is like you said, during the course of the discussion, you know, we as workers, like I said, are not really educated sometimes about the law as it stands, that there can be more come of that, and it can draw more people into it. You know, one of the things I always wanted to know is that we oftentimes think we all hear that reference of someone is fired for union activity. Is that the most common unfair labor practice?
It's a pretty typical charge. I would say probably just based on my experience that in Region 7, which is on the western side of Michigan and Grand Rapids here, the most common charge is filed by a union alleging that the employer has changed something without bargaining, has maybe changed the shifts or wages or has discontinued a practice. That's probably the most common charge that we see in recent years. But we do get quite a few charges that somebody's been fired or disciplined because of their union activities. And increasingly, we're seeing cases where people say it was my concerted activities, not really union activities yet, but just one employee reaching out to others or speaking on behalf of others or employees acting together to bring a grievance or a complaint to their employer. Increasingly, we're seeing that's in the case mix, too.
We're talking to Tom Good, the resident officer of the National Labor Relations Board in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and you're listening to the Union Edge, and we're going to take a short break.
It's about the work. Work we're proud of. Work that provides the energy that powers America. Work that means our communities are stronger, better, for our families, our neighbors, for everyone. Just like you, members of the United Mine Workers of America are on the job, every day, working hard. It's what we do, and it makes America a better place. The United Mine Workers of America, working families just like yours.
Sisters and brothers, are you buried in paperwork? UnionTrack is a software platform that streamlines your administrative work so you can spend less time chasing databases and more time taking care of your members. UnionTrack was created to streamline your day-to-day operations, allowing you to focus on organizing, training, and advocating for working families. More information is available at UnionTrack.com and on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn.
Welcome back to the Union Edge, the Labor's Talk Radio. My name is Angela Bachman. I've spent the day here with Brittany Sheets, and we have Buck Gino joining us right now.
It's great to be with you, ladies, always on Friday, always.
Always good to have you, and you also brought Tom Good with you today.
Yes, Tom's the resident officer of the National Labor Relations Board, and like I said, in our efforts at the Union Edge to educate ourselves and also our not-yet-union brothers and sisters about the support out there from the National Labor Relations Board. We have Tom Good. Thanks for joining us, Tom. We appreciate it.
It's always my pleasure, Buck, and hello to Angela and Brittany, too, and all of your listeners.
You know, one of the things we were talking about, Tom, was we were talking about the unfair labor practice and what it is and how it takes place. Tell us a little bit about, after you've gathered it, your investigators gathered the evidence, What's the timing before there's, and what happens, and then the timing for basically a decision?
Well, every case when it comes in is assigned kind of a priority depending on the nature of the allegations. When we have a charge that involves, for instance, the permanent loss of employment, if somebody's been fired, that's a high category case, and we try to put those on a fast track. A case that involves a minor change at the workplace where there already is a union contract that a grievance procedure might be able to work it out too. That's on a somewhat slower track, or I'd say a less fast track. But generally, it takes like 6 to 11 weeks for us to investigate a case. And that may seem like a long time, and especially to somebody who's been fired, that is a long time. But the requirements of due process are such that we have to give both sides a chance to get their arguments and their evidence in front of us. We have to analyze it. We have to, the agent makes a report to the regional director, who is the one who is ultimately responsible for making the decisions. Do we think that there's a violation here or not? And then we move from that, then we're talking about moving from the investigative phase to what happens next. When that decision is made, if we think that there's insufficient evidence of a violation or it doesn't look to us like the law was broken, we give the charging party, the person who filed the charge, the opportunity to withdraw the case, or if they want to exercise their right to an appeal, we will issue a dismissal letter, and then they have a couple of weeks during which they can file an appeal. The appeal process, just in a nutshell, is that when somebody appeals a dismissal, we send the case down to our folks in Washington who look at it with fresh eyes and decide if we've made a mistake or if we haven't given proper weight to the evidence. Sometimes, it doesn't happen very often, at least in this office, we're told that we should reverse ourselves and go ahead and issue a complaint or try to settle the case. If we find a violation, then we immediately move into a settlement phase. We try to get the parties together. We have certain requirements for each type of a violation that we have to adhere to in order to safeguard the public rights. But generally, we encourage the parties to try to be creative and see if they can work it out between themselves. We don't let a lot of time go by in that phase. It can be a few days. It can be a week or more. And if we don't get a settlement quickly, we issue a document called a complaint. The complaint just sets forth in item by item the facts that we think establish that there was a violation, and we set a hearing date. It can be 4 weeks to 2 or 3 months down the road that we get a hearing date, and if we still try to work out a settlement, but if no settlement is arrived at by the time that hearing date comes around, a judge with a specialty in labor law comes out to the hearing location, and then it's like a trial. We have to prove our case by calling witnesses and introducing documents. The other side does the same, and then and there's a court reporter there. It looks just like you would expect a hearing or a trial to look on TV. There's a judge. There are opposing counsel, attorneys. There are witnesses who are called to the stand, and objections are being made and ruled on, overruled, sustained. At the end of that process, the judge retires to her or his chambers and starts to write a decision. It can take a few weeks, a few months, depending on the size of the case, and the judge issues a decision saying whether they think there was a violation, whether they agree with the regional director, was there a violation or not.
So if the judge finds that the employer perhaps is guilty, and then you went through all this process of these weeks and sometimes months, then say if someone was fired for concerted activity or a union activity, then they would be eligible for back pay, correct?
Correct. If somebody is fired unlawfully, the remedy that we look for and we really try to obtain in every case is an offer of reinstatement that the employee can accept or not, and to be made whole. We want to figure out what they would have earned had they not been fired. We subtract from that anything that they may have earned in the meantime if they found other employment. Whatever that total is, that's what we think the back pay should be. Plus, we want interest to be factored into that, calculated on a daily basis, so that we can't. The act, the law, does not permit the imposition of a punishment, a fine, or punitive damages, but it does allow us to try to make people whole. To try to put Humpty back together again, which isn't always easy to do, but we try to put people back to where they would be if there hadn't been an unfair labor practice, an unlawful discharge.
You know, that's very good information to have, and we need to take some time to let the people know how they can contact the National Labor Relations Board
even if they just have a question and they're not sure. Let us know how people can contact you. For sure.
We're always happy in all of the regions and all of the 50 offices of the NLRB across the country to answer people's questions about their rights under the law. If you don't know your local NLRB office number, you can call our main national line, which is 1-866-667-6572. That's 866-667-NLRB. You can get quite an education about your rights under the National Labor Relations Act at our website, which is www.nlrb.gov.
You know, once again, the number, Tom, the telephone number?
It's 866-667-6572.
And better yet, if you have a group of people or, you know, your fellow workers who just want to find out from someone, a real person, you have an outreach program through the board, right, that will go out and speak to any group?
We are happy to speak to groups of almost any size, classes, Rotary clubs, groups of employees who want to meet with a board agent after work at a bowling alley or a bar or restaurant. We'll make people available wherever the questions are. So don't hesitate to ask.
And I think this is very important for us as the union members to make sure that we're, like I talked about earlier, to let our not yet union brothers and sisters, our neighbors, our friends and family, know there is a source for them to go to get some sort of help. That being said, Tom, thank you very much for joining us. We appreciate it. We always appreciate the National Labor Relations Board participation on this program. And for Charles Showalter, Angela Bachman, Brittany Sheets, I'm Buck Gino, and you've been listening to The Union Edge, Labor Stock Radio, and we appreciate it.
This is Solidarity News on Radio Labor.
This is the Radio Labor World Report, recorded on Friday, February 27th, 2015. I'm Mark Belanger. In the report this week, unions win a huge victory for the international right to strike. Oil workers in the United States are headed into the fifth week of their national strike. The Mexican government is found guilty of union-busting activities in Canada. And labor organizations are preparing for the World March of Women. All that plus the global Labor Start Report. This is Radio Labor. Unions at the International Labor Organization, the ILO, have won a major victory. A special meeting of government, union, and employer representatives this week resolved a long-standing dispute and agreed that there is an international right to strike. The conclusion was tied to the ILO's Convention on Freedom of Association, the right to form a union. The ILO is the specialized agency of the United Nations, which is focused on matters of work in the world. It is managed in a tripartite fashion by representatives of governments, employers, and unions. Most labor centrals, such as the AFL-CIO in the United States, participate in ILO activities. The meeting to discuss the right to strike came after 2 years of pushing by the employers to deny the right to strike. The result would have been that governments that have ratified Convention 87 on freedom of association would have been legally allowed to deny the right to strike as part of the bargaining process. As well, ILO committees would not have been able to cite countries as being in contravention of Convention 87 if they restricted the right to strike. The employers held up the supervisory mechanisms of the ILO for more than 2 years. The agreement at the ILO meetings this week comes after a successful day of action by unions on February 18th. The day was supported by more than 100 actions in 60 countries. It was organized by the International Trade Union Confederation. Meanwhile, in the United States, some 6,000 oil workers are exercising their right to strike by walking the picket lines to demand better safety protections. The workers are members of the United Steelworkers Union, the USW, which represents 30,000 oil workers in the U.S. The strike started February 2nd. talks between the union and Royal Dutch Shell, which is leading the negotiations for the oil companies, were held on Friday, February 20th, but failed to resolve the issues. The primary issue is health and safety and the use of contract staff who are not adequately trained in safe working procedures. Lynn Hancock is a spokesperson for the United Steelworkers.
Our workers end up having to work huge amounts of overtime. We're striking over health and safety issues and health care benefits. Our proposals would not cost the industry that much money, and they can well afford it. Even with the fewer profits they're making now, they still make billions of dollars, and they can afford to make these refineries safer so that our workers don't get killed and injured, and the community doesn't suffer.
A Canadian court has found the government of Mexico guilty of anti-union activities. The court in the province of British Columbia ruled that the Mexican government blacklisted migrant workers from returning to Canada because of their union activities in Canada. The workers had been employed at a nursery called Sidhu and Sons, where a local of the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, the UFCW, was being organized. I talked to Paul Minema, the national president of UFCW Canada. I asked him how many workers had been blacklisted and how the Mexican government found out who amongst the workers were the active unionists.
What prompted the attention of the Mexican government would have been the connection between the farmer himself and the sending country, in this case, Mexico, in which the farmer was not happy that the workers had joined the union and had negotiated a collective agreement. So where this would have caught the attention of the Mexican government is that the farmers would have complained about the process and wouldn't want these particular farm workers back working on their farm. The Mexican government or an agent of the government would have worked with the farmer to prevent certain workers coming back to Sidhu and Sons farm nursery in Mission, BC.
But now the question becomes for the Mexican government: so what? It can decide who leaves the country. It doesn't report to the Canadian government. How will Mexico react to the court's ruling?
Well, I think it's bigger than that. I think it's bigger than a so what. I mean, you have a Canadian labor tribunal and then a Superior Court of BC, acknowledging that this behavior took place, acknowledging that there were agents of the Mexican government involved in this behavior, including with a Canadian employer. So I think not only is it embarrassing, but it also indicates that there are rules here that have to be. I think it's very embarrassing for the Mexican government that they would allow their own folks to be to be treated this way, allow their own folks to be and be a part of sending their own citizens to a country and working with agencies inside of that country to reduce the rights of their own workers. So I think there's a larger impact on this now. Sending countries are in competition to send workers to Canada. This is a big business. There's money in it for the countries that send, as in the finances that go back for workers that are working here sending their money back. But I think it also, because of that competition, it also, with this type of thing, if there's not a acknowledgement or recognizing that this is not the behavior that they want to be involved in, is will they be suspect in the future? And the government is responsible for the protection of their own workers when they send them to another country.
International labor bodies are calling on unions to support the World March of Women on March 8th. Radio Labor's senior correspondent C. Marie Ainsborough has a report.
The International Trade Union Confederation, the ITUC, is calling on its affiliates to participate in the 4th World March of Women. The march will be held on International Women's Day, March 8th. The ITUC is the organization which represents national labor centrals at the world level. The first World March of Women was held in 2000, with the participation of more than 6,000 women's groups and unions. Every year since then, the march has grown as people march for equal pay for work of equal value, social justice, a caring economy, and other issues. The ITUC is participating in the march as part of its Count Us In campaign. It wants women to be counted into national economies, labor forces, decision-making, and leadership. This is C. Marie Ainsborough reporting for Radio Labor.
Now here with his report about the activities of Labor Start, the labor movement's news and campaigning service, is Derek Blackadder.
Every 6 minutes, a new story about a union somewhere around the world is posted on Labor Start. Here's a small sample of the news we collected since our last report. Ghanaian dental clinic workers walked off their jobs last week to protest the lack of progress in wage discussions. Mauritanian miners downed tools in an effort to gain a living wage. Retail workers in the Bahamas were suffering from the flu as thousands called in sick last week. The flu being highly contagious, Bahamas telecom workers also caught the bug just as their employer announced mass layoffs. American telecom workers ended a month-long strike, the biggest in American history, with a significant victory. Mine workers in Zambia walked off the job to protest layoffs. Teachers in the Philippines held a one-day sit-in strike to back their union's demand for a wage increase. Cambodian garment workers started picketing when an after-hours protest against low wages was attacked by their managers. And Indian municipal workers stopped work as their union pressed their demands for the reorganization of their service. Our top working women's stories included coverage of the creation of a domestic workers' union in Pakistan with members as young as 11, the news that the gender pay gap in Australia has hit a new high thanks to government policies, and how the so-called 0 hours contracts of employment common in Britain hit women hardest. Next week, look for coverage of the planned civil service strike in Nigeria and the court action against the further expansion of McDonald's launched by Brazilian unions. This week, Labor Start is running 5 online actions. All these campaigns are requested by and sponsored by unions around the world. This is Derek Blackadder from Labor Start, reporting for Radio Labor.
And that's it. International labor news you can use. Radio Labor's newscasts are available on its website, Facebook, iTunes, Twitter, mobile phones, and community radio stations. I'm Mark Belanger. Thank you for listening. And remember, it's all about global solidarity.
The Union Edge Talk Radio Show. Often robust, but always respectful. Standing up for your working family.